Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly guide to all the hottest stories and trends from the technology world. I'm Rory Catherine-Jones, and this week we'll be looking at what could be an important moment for the future of electric cars. We'll find out about the promise and pitfalls of facial recognition technology. And a neuroscientist tells us why facts don't work on the internet. Joining me to help us guide us through all of this is BBC Online technology correspondent Mark Ward. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Rory.
Good to have you here. And my special guest is Tom Standage, deputy editor of The Economist and a prolific technology author. He's also going to be telling us about the Economist facial recognition special this week. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Welcome to the tent. Here's a flavour of what's coming up.
We have to remember that Nissan is not Tesla, nor does it want to be. It's selling a car for mainstream car buyers.
What we find is that when people receive data that doesn't conform to what they already believe, they tend to rationalise it away. They would say, oh, you know, the source is not credible or the data is not credible.
All of that in a minute. But first, another major security breach, and this time at a business holding very sensitive information about hundreds of millions of people. The credit scoring company Equifax says the personal details of 143 million American customers may have fallen into the hands of hackers. Mark Ward's been following this story. Mark, what's the latest?
Well, there was a statement yesterday from Equifax, but, you know, at the moment the details are fairly scant. We know, like say, it's 143 million customers affected. Information about social security numbers, birth dates, addresses has gone missing, but the bad guys didn't get at their core databases, which has information on 800 million people and 90 million businesses. This happened in May and July through some sort of web application vulnerability.
It happened in May and July, and we're only hearing about it in September.
That's right, yeah. I think, and the fact that they've set up a website to help people that is not coping with the amount of people that are turning up to find out if they've been affected is not great. The chief exec of the firm said it was disappointing, and I think a lot of people are agreeing with him.
I love the fact that, yeah, the chief executive came out with a statement saying it was disappointing for the company. Mm. That seems like a bit of an understatement. I mean, for a company which is about data and about personal data, and in some ways is about helping you keep your personal data safe from identity thieves, that's its core mission. It's a pretty big failure, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think, you know, generally your bad guys don't get out of bed for, you know, breaches of less than 250 million records. But I think the quality of this information is going to be good and they're going to like that. And there's already reports that on the dark web people are offering chunks of this data. So, you know, it's juicy stuff. So we'll see how it develops. But details are fairly scant at the moment.
Yes, I've been trying to get in contact with the company all day to find out how many UK customers are affected. They're using that well-worn method, an external PR company, which can tell you nothing. And the company's share price is also falling sharply. We'll move on. Every week seems to bring more news of the move to electric motoring, with many of the headlines centering on Tesla. Its Model 3 has been touted as the Model T Ford of the electric era, bringing an affordable battery-powered car to the mass market. But maybe a traditional car company could be better placed to do that. The Nissan Leaf has been neck and neck with Tesla's Model S as the world's best-selling electric car. And this week, the Japanese company unveiled a new version of the vehicle, giving it a much improved range. Here's a TV ad they played at the launch. New Nissan Leaf. Simply amazing. Pretty exciting, huh? The electric car blogger Nikki Gordon-Bloomfield was in Tokyo to attend that launch, and she told me it was rather different from a traditional motor industry event.
There were journalists and people from all around the world. Very interestingly, though, for this launch, I think Nissan focused more on tech journalists and tech industry experts than they did traditional car journalists, which shows how very influential the tech sector is in the adoption of the electric car.
And what was the general impression of this new Leaf? Is it a big leap forward? Obviously a much greater range than before.
Well, the range of the new Leaf is about twice the range of the original Leaf. And some of the issues that we have here revolve around the fact that different countries have different ways of figuring out how far a car will travel per charge. In fact, they have different ways of figuring out how far a car will travel on any unit of fuel, whether it be petrol or electricity. And in Japan, the JC08 test cycle predicts that this car will do 400 kilometres per charge, which is a phenomenal distance, whereas the American system, that which is, by the way, the most realistic in terms of replicating real-world driving situations, is estimating about 150 miles. Europe, meanwhile, in the middle, is about 230 miles. So the Leaf will be sold in Europe as having a 230-mile range, where actually the reality will be about 150. Now, this is not a car that is going to be revolutionary, more that it's an evolutionary car. We have to remember that Nissan is not Tesla, nor does it want to be. It's selling a car for mainstream car buyers, and thus the car is appropriate to the needs of a mainstream car buyer. There's a medium amount of tech. There's nothing too flashy inside. There's a decent-sized boot space. There's room for five passengers. And the performance and the price point is engineered to try and get as many people to switch to an electric car as possible, not necessarily win the stoplight derby.
You say it's not a Tesla, but Tesla's made a great play of its new Model 3. It's had a huge amount of publicity for it. Isn't the truth that the Nissan Leaf is likely to be perhaps a more influential car on the road to electric driving?
As Nissan itself noted, and I spoke to several different Nissan executives, the Nissan Leaf is a car that is backed up by decades and decades and decades of manufacturing experience, which Nissan believes will give it an edge when it comes to selling this car to mainstream buyers. A lot of people who buy Teslas are early adopters. They're tech savvy. And a lot of people are put off by the high-tech nature of the Tesla Model S, the Model X, and the Model 3. I think where Nissan's edge lies is that it's a mainstream car built for mainstream people. And when Nissan launched the Leaf today, it actually said this is not an electric car. This is a car that happens to be electric.
That's Nikki Gordon-Bloomfield at the Nissan Leaf launch. Tom Standage, our special guest from The Economist. There's a lot of hype around electric cars at the moment, lots of people setting deadlines for when petrol and diesel cars will stop being sold. How fast do you think this revolution is coming? Is it overhyped?
No, I think actually this is happening faster than people realise. The rate at which batteries are getting better is astonishing, and in fact, it's much faster than people expected. And if you look at other transitions like the switch from landlines to mobile phones or digital cameras to film cameras, they happened, you know, apparently the digital cameras were just for enthusiasts and people said, well, they'll have to get to 70 megapixels before they can rival film. And actually, those sorts of comparisons which people are making now about electric cars, when people see the advantages and they start thinking about transport in a different way, instead of just kind of comparing them to petrol cars and saying, well, has it got as much range? That kind of doesn't matter anymore. It starts to become a different thing.
It does matter if, for instance, I want to recharge it outside my house and I live on a London street with and don't want to stretch a cable across the pavement. Surely there's an awful lot of infrastructure that needs to be built first.
So along with range anxiety, I mean, I think this is another thing that people worry about. You don't have a petrol station in your house, but somehow you manage. It turns out that most people in Britain drive less than drive an average of 40 kilometres a day. 80% of people drive less than 100 kilometres a day. So actually, if you've got a car that will do 200 kilometres, you'll only have to recharge it, you know, every few days. And therefore, it is something you can do when you go to the supermarket or something like that. So I think this is the sort of thing where we think there's a big barrier. But if we see other people switching, then it might change the way we think about it, as happened with digital cameras and mobile phones.
And also, we're going to have a different model where few of us own cars, but there are going to be a bunch of electric cars around for us to borrow from.
There's also the kind of carpooling. And then I think if you look further ahead, I mean, these predictions about, you know, you're not going to be able to buy an internal combustion engine car in several European countries by 2040, 2050. I think actually we won't want to buy them much sooner than that. And I don't think we should look at this as how long will it take before all the cars in the world today are electric? Because I think in future, if we've got self-driving cars in particular, we might be able to make do with a much smaller number of cars. Some people say as few as 10% of the number of cars we have today could provide the same amount of mobility services. So I think we need to kind of step back and say this isn't just about taking something we have and just changing the engine to an electric motor and everything else stays the same, because actually making that change comes with a whole load of other changes as well.
You heard that prediction here first. We'll only need 10% of the current level of cars by 2050. We'll be checking back on that in a few years' time. Now, let's have a look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Mark Ward. Mark, Amazon's employing more and more robots, but also more and more people.
That's right. Strangely enough, it wants to build a second HQ in North America. It's going to spend $5 billion over the next 15 years building that. 50,000 people will be employed then. Obviously, there's a multiplier effect of it setting that up. And that started a bit of a rush by very large cities to court Jeff Bezos and get Amazon to plonk down their HQ. So Austin, Boston, Dallas, Chicago, Denver, Phoenix, Toronto, they're all in the frame for perhaps that very large building.
We've reported on so-called ICOs, initial coin offerings, where businesses raise money by offering new currency. In fact, I've written about one this week called Wild Crypto, which offers coins to play in a new lottery. For some reason, you're going to want to buy coins to play in their lottery. Don't understand it. But now, here's the story. China has banned these ICOs. Why?
Well, it says they're risky. And I don't think anyone would disagree with that, that they do represent something of a risk if you are swapping cryptocurrencies for tokens in a startup scheme. And generally, these are fundraising schemes for new companies trying to do all kinds of things. But Bitcoin is hugely popular in China, and a lot of people use it to evade currency controls. And I suspect that's got more to do with this banning. But, it's like the net sees censorship as damage and tries to root around it. Excuse me. I suspect the crypto cash folks will see regulation as damage and try and root around it and recover and find another way to get their cash into other people's hands.
Tom Standage, do you understand ICOs? I've been trying to grapple with them. And are you a believer?
I think I got my head around blockchain. And the trouble with ICOs is just when you've got your head around Bitcoin and blockchain, another idea which then sort of assumes you understand that and then builds on top of it comes along, which is, where you issue your own currency in order, like an IPO. So I think I understand that. And I think it's possibly a model that might be useful in the future. So I think it's very interesting and it's worth following, but that doesn't mean that an awful lot of the ICOs happening now aren't scams, and an awful lot of them look like they are. So I could entirely understand a regulator saying, look, we don't understand this, and if we don't understand it, it might be dodgy, and let's ban the whole thing.
Put the brakes on.
Yeah, exactly.
One final story. A new threat to the security of voice-controlled speakers like the Amazon Echo or the Google Home using commands that can't be heard by humans, Mark.
That's right. Strangely enough, yes, it's called the Dolphin Attack because it uses high frequency, the kinds of noises that dolphins make. And this is so two research teams have used those ultrasonic commands to make the Amazon, Apple, Google voice controlled assistants, open websites and things like that. And to be honest, it's a bit theoretical, but it's quite quirky. And because to be honest, how on earth would you accomplish an attack by?
Well, there is one method, because some of them are connected to door opening and car opening services, so you can imagine a high pitched whistle saying open the door, but it does seem a bit theoretical. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service with Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, why facts may not help you argue on the internet. Now, facial recognition is a technology that's come a long way in recent years. It's used in mobile phones these days as a means of secure login. It's used at borders to automate the checking of passports and by various law enforcement agencies to spot suspects or previous offenders. But it's also very controversial. Here in Britain, there was an outcry over the use of facial recognition at the annual Notting Hill Carnival with accusations that it amounted to a form of racial profiling. This week's edition of The Economist has a special report on the technology, and the deputy editor, Tom Standage, our special guest, has been following its development for years. Tom, how far has it got? How good, how accurate are computers at recognising individual faces?
It's one of those things where they're now better than humans. So we have this list of things that, we used to be better at everything because there were no computers. And then computers came along and then they were better than us at playing chess. And they were better than us at playing Go. And one of the things they have recently become better than us at doing is recognising faces. And in particular, there is an annual competition called Megaface, where you have a sort of all of the facial recognition technologies pitted against each other. And if you look at the results from that, humans, if you give a human two pictures and say of the same person and say, are these the same person or are they not the same person? Humans get it right about 97.6% of the time. So correctly identifying whether two pictures show the same person. The best machines in the world now, in fact, the two best are the Chinese systems made by Baidu and Tencent. They are right 99.8% of the time.
Right. It's getting pretty good.
Yeah, it is extremely good. And what that means is that these neural net-based systems can see features in faces that most humans can't.
Now, you report on one study this week about identifying people who are gay or who are straight simply by looking at photos. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so this is a story written by my colleague Hal Hodson, who is one of our gurus on artificial intelligence. And it's a piece of research done by people at Stanford. And what they did was they took pictures from a dating site. And on that dating site, people had identified whether they were straight or gay. So they had this big database of people who were straight and gay, and they used that to train a neural network. And then they showed it new pictures where they hadn't, where they didn't tell the network whether this person was straight or gay. And it was able to say whether they were or not 81% of the time, for men at least, and slightly less accurately for women. And humans, on the other hand, are much less accurate. Humans are about 60% accurate with men and a bit less than that for women. So what this means is that there seem to be facial characteristics which do indicate sexuality, at least in some people. And that it also means that machines are able to see them in a way that humans can't.
You can see this technology possibly being pretty controversial, can't you?
Oh, absolutely, because you can imagine. I mean, the thing is, we have to remember this is based on, you know, population level studies, as it were. It's based on thousands of pictures. Firstly, also, it should be pointed out that these are taken from a dating site. And on a dating site, it's very likely you're trying to send signals, sexual signals. So, you know, we don't know how representative that is. And also, it was only done using white people. So we don't know how this extends to other ethnic groups. But you can imagine, though, it could be very worrying if an authoritarian government, for example, wants to build a system that, you know, in a country like Uganda or Nigeria, that tries to sort of spot gay people or not give you a visa or deny you benefits or whatever if you're gay. And of course, this system is working when you give it a picture of, you give it two pictures and you say one of these people is gay and one is straight, which is which? That's very different from here are 1,000 people, which people are gay. And it's much less accurate doing that. It gets it right. It basically has a very large number of false positives. And that's potentially very worrying if governments are going to start trying to use this technology.
Briefly, should we be excited or just mainly worried about this technology?
Well, it has a lot of good uses as well. We see it being used. The new iPhone that's announced next week is expected to use face-based unlocking. It could be more accurate and safer than passwords in a lot of applications. So you can imagine sort of good security uses of this. We're seeing a face-based check-in in some airports, face-based payment in China. So I think in the rich world, in the sort of liberal democratic world, certainly this is something we might be able to regulate so that we can ensure that we just do the good things. But I think what we get worried about is what China might do with it, what Russia might do with it, and so forth. And that's really where the sort of scary uses of this come into play.
Yeah, plenty of use of that in China right now. Now, there's a cartoon I like where a woman asks a man, when is he coming to bed? And he says, I can't, someone is wrong on the internet. It sums up just how we can be drawn into arguments online with people who seem to be immune to reason. But a neuroscientist at University College London says we're probably wasting our time if we think facts will change people's minds. Tali Sharot has written a book called The Influential Mind about how the methods we use in argument don't work because they don't fit with the way the mind operates. I asked her to explain.
What we find is that when people receive data that doesn't conform to what they already believe, they tend to rationalize it away. They would say, oh, you know, the source is not credible, or the data is not credible, or the conclusion drawn from it is not quite right, or they simply ignore it altogether. And when people receive data that does conform to what they believe or what they want to believe, then they just have open arms, right? They take the data in and their views are strengthened. What this is resulting in is polarization. Because you can find information to support anything that you want to. And so people do. And it actually takes groups to more extremes.
So have you any optimistic advice here, say, for scientists wanting to convince the public on anything from the world being round to climate change being a threat to vaccines are generally safe?
Yeah. So I think what we really need to realize is that fighting these biases that we have, like the confirmation bias, is not very helpful. We can't really change millions of years of evolution. Our mind, our brain works in a certain way because of some reasons. Some of them are very good reasons. And trying to say, well, it shouldn't be like that, that doesn't work. What we need to do is actually go along with how the mind works, go along with the biases that we already have. So, for example, parents who refuse to vaccinate their kids because they think there's a link to autism, they're usually not convinced when doctors tell them, look, here's all the data suggesting there's no link. They already have a strong view and it doesn't convince them. And that, unfortunately, is the approach that most healthcare systems are using, and it's not very helpful. But instead, a group of scientists tried a different approach, which is they gave the parents more information about how the vaccines is helping to protect children from the mumps and rubella, right, from the illnesses that it's supposed to be protecting from. They didn't disagree with that, but it seems that they forgot about it in the debate. And so highlighting beliefs that everyone agreed on, that they have in common, and motivations that they have in common, everyone wanted the kids to be healthy, had a great effect. It changed their attitudes towards vaccines 3 times as much than the normal approach. So starting with common grounds is one way to go.
Are you an optimist when you look at this phenomenon? Because it's pretty difficult to be optimistic given what you've said.
Absolutely. It is difficult. I don't know if I'm exactly an optimist, but I do think we need to start thinking about it in a different way. Interestingly enough, in fact, the more intelligent you are, according to a study that was conducted in Yale University, the more likely you are to have a confirmation bias. So it's not a case where you think, oh, this is a problem of, you know, the less intelligent. No, it's a problem of everyone, and in fact, even more to people who have better analytical skills.
Tali Sharot, the author of The Influential Mind. Tom Standage, our special guest from The Economist. The whole mission of your life and of your publication is to give people facts and hope that they'll be persuaded by them. Publication is quite argumentative, some people might
say. It is indeed. I don't believe the study at all. Sorry, this can't be right. It's just, I'm going to ignore it. It doesn't fit the way I see the world. So I'm just going to pretend it hasn't been. No, I'm not really. Obviously this is embarrassing. I remember it is difficult for those of us who champion a fact-based view of the world, members of the fact-based community, when we're reminded that actually facts don't really change people's minds.
And the depressing thing is that we've got far more facts out there. We've got, the internet should have given us this great sort of arena for, you know, debate and with access to all sorts of evidence, and we've got worse.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, we are trying to do our bit on that front. I mean, one of the things that, you know, we pride ourselves on at The Economist is trying to be a filter you can trust on all of that information. And the more stuff there is out there, the more people seem to want to read The Economist. But I'm reminded of what Clay Shirky said, who's a media critic in America. And after Donald Trump won the election, he was sort of lamenting how terrible it was. And one of the things he said was that the supporters of Hillary Clinton had taken a fact checker to a gunfight. And I think that's exactly right, that people really are sort of talking past each other and approaching the world in different ways. And if you assume that everyone is on the fact-based community, you're not necessarily going to be right.
Well, here's one fact that there's no argument about. We've run out of time again. Thanks to my special guest, Tom Standage from The Economist. Thanks to Mark Ward from the BBC Technology Desk. Read all of his stories and mine at bbc.com/technology. Don't forget to tell your friends about the podcast of this show and join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The food chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.